Ah, summer. We're spending time basking in the sun, at the rivers and the ocean, on the porch and in the park. But as activists and anarchists, we're also reading. Tonight on Circle A Radio, we have a summer reading program with people who run bookstores and book groups, printers, authors, and of course, readers sharing what they're reading. Stay tuned.
I'm Jordy from North Star Info Shop. We've been working on this for about a year and a half, and we provide books and a space to meet and hang out for free. We are really passionate about creating a space for anarchist information and gathering, and we thought that an info shop would be a really good way to do that.
And I'm Shanti, also from North Star. An info shop is a bookstore with a significantly, I guess, social bent. It's like a bookstore and community center, like, hybrid. As you're kind of like navigating the political world and trying to figure out how to make the world a better place and what you believe in, it's nice to be able to talk and engage with other people. Having a place explicitly for that is nice.
We opened on June 1st, and it's definitely been a rocky start. Making money is hard. We have two really big bookshelves with lots of books on them. Some of my favorite books that we have right now are Enemies in Blue by Christian Williams, American Methods, also by Christian Williams, Resistance Behind Bars by Vicki Law. We have a like feminist and women's section. We have a sustainability and urban farming section, I guess. We also have parenting, a parenting section, a prison abolition section, and $5 and $1 books, which are really great and inexpensive. And that's on one big bookshelf. And in between the two big bookshelves, we have a bunch of really beautiful Eberhardt Press notepads and a bunch of the zines that he has put out as well underneath. Then the collective tarot deck and another big bookshelf of books and a bunch of beautiful Just Seeds art prints on the wall. And a big free section of propaganda and magazines. Then behind me, which is across the room from the big bookshelves, the room is very small, so it's not very far from them. We have some crime thing stuff, like Recipes for Disaster, then some art made by our friend Allie that's up on the other wall. We have four walls covered with really great things and big windows. We share the space with a bookstore called Copyleft Books, run by our friends Adam and Love. They have a lot of really great books. Almost all of them are used, and they have a lot of really great mass market paperbacks from the 60s and 70s and beyond. A lot of Black Panther history and a lot of vintage sci-fi and fantasy books. They have a really, really wide selection of books that are really great. North Star mostly carries new, and Copyleft mostly carries really awesome used books, and so we complement each other really well and don't generally have much of an overlap. You don't feel like you're walking from one bookstore to another that is the same. You have, like, a lot more to look at. We have a new book group that just started. It's called the Feminist Reading Group. We can help them get books for cheaper, and they can help us make a little bit of money.
And we've been kind of co-coordinating it with them and hosting in here. Resistance Behind Bars, that's their book that they selected for the first reading group.
Victoria Law is the author of Resistance Behind Bars, The Struggles of Incarcerated Women. We'll now listen to a presentation she made at Blue Stockings Books in New York City, in conjunction with the New York City Anarchist Book Fair and the Left Forum, New York City. The event took place April 14, 2009. This is Victoria Law.
In 1974, in Bedford Hills, which is about an hour and a half away from here in Westchester County, five male guards beat a prisoner organizer named Carol Crooks, who incidentally was a social prisoner, or she didn't go in for a political crime, but became political in prison, and placed her in segregation without a hearing. The month before that, Carol Crooks had won a court injunction against the prison, placing women in segregation without a hearing. So obviously this was retaliatory. The women around her protested. They took over portions of the prison and held seven staff members hostage. They held the prison until the state called in male state troopers and male guards from neighboring male prisons. When the state retook the prison, 25 women were injured and 24 women were transferred to the Mateo Juan complex for the criminally insane without the required hearings. Keep in mind this happened 3 years after Attica, only a few hours away from Attica, and somehow this has been erased from our collective history. This is not the only case in which women have rioted sort of at the height of prisoner activism and the prison justice movement. In 1975, women at the North Carolina Correctional Center for Women held a sit-down demonstration to demand better medical care, improved services, and the closing of the prison laundry. When the guards tried to corral them into the gymnasium, they used the poles from volleyball nets, chunks of concrete, and hoe handles to drive the guards out of the prison. And it wasn't until over 100 guards from other state prisons were summoned in that they were that the prison administration was able to retake the prison and retain order. So one thing that I want you all to think about while I'm talking is, why have we collectively forgotten these uprisings? While we remember things like Attica, we remember the Lucasville uprisings, we remember all the uprisings that have happened in male prisons, why is it that we don't remember what happened in the female prisons? These days, we don't hear about work strikes, sit-down demonstrations, and other more visible forms of resistance, but that doesn't mean that they're not happening inside prisons, and they are happening inside women's prisons as well. So I wanted to touch on a few examples of past and current women's organizing that has been overlooked when we are looking at what constitutes prisoner activism and prisoner resistance. One issue that I wanted to talk about is healthcare. Women in prison are more likely to be HIV positive than either men in prison or women on the outside. A study done in 2000 found that women in prison were 60% more likely to have HIV than men in prison, and women in prison are 36 times more likely than women on the outside to have HIV. So this accounts to the fact that a lot of women in prison come from the lowest socioeconomic ladder, lowest socioeconomic class. They aren't usually getting healthcare services. There's no preventative healthcare services. And then they're going into prison and they're not really getting treatment. In 1987, again at Bedford Hills, an hour and a half from here, women imprisoned at Bedford Hills recognized that they needed to form some sort of peer education program to deal with the fact that so many women were coming in HIV positive, that there was a huge amount of stigma and ostracism of women in prison, of women who were HIV positive, both from fellow prisoners and from staff members. Many people were afraid that people with HIV would breathe on them and they would somehow catch the disease. Women were chased off of housing units. If they went to the intensive care unit, staff members, including medical staff, didn't want to deal with them. One woman actually died by herself one night in the intensive care unit because there was no nurse willing to attend to her. So with these horrific conditions, women incarcerated at Bedford Hills, both two political prisoners and many social prisoners, women who were not incarcerated for political crimes and were not political before going to prison, decided that they wanted to form ACE, the AIDS Counseling and Education Program. And they recognized that prisoners had to play an active role in combating these stereotypes and not just rely on somebody to come in from the outside once a month to give a training that no one listened to. So first they started by asking the administration if they could go in and tend to the HIV-positive women in the intensive care unit. And because no one on staff wanted to deal with HIV-positive women, the administration agreed. ACE later expanded so that members helped women prepare for their medical exams by working with them to define and articulate their questions. So they would ask them, how are you feeling? What do you want to know? And let's figure out how we can talk to the medical staff when we go to your consultation. They would accompany women to consultations to help facilitate their interactions with medical staff. They presented educational seminars to women and used role-playing to break through some of the stereotypes and barriers to generate discussion and examine the issues. In 1999, the New York Times ran a story about the AIDS Counseling and Education Program and quoted one woman as saying, "If you hear stigma now, there are five people who immediately say, 'Why did you have to say that? It's not okay anymore. And I know that this is a direct result of the program and the education process.'" In contrast, prisons that don't have these peer education programs, even today, even in 2009, have a huge amount of stigma, ignorance, and ostracism. I got a letter last year from a woman in Oklahoma's Mabel Bassett Correctional Center who wrote, "The level of ignorance here is shocking. Women say stuff like, 'I don't want to wash my clothes after her. What if her panties were bloody?' People don't want to share cells or meals, so most women just keep their status a secret." When you keep your status a secret in prison, that also means that you don't go for medical treatment because you don't want people to know that you're HIV positive. So many women with HIV will actually not go and seek treatment, and their condition will just get worse and worse in prison. One thing I also wanted to mention is that ACE is still in operation today, and their model has spread to other women's prisons, both in New York State and throughout the country, although sometimes with less success.
That was Victoria Law speaking in New York City on April 14th, 2009, about her book, Resistance Behind Bars, The Struggles of Incarcerated Women. We now go back to our interview with Jordy and Shanti of North Star Info Shop. This is Jordy.
We do have Project of the Months, which is essentially where we put a project up on the wall with a donation jar and tell people about it. And that for June was Books to Prisoners. So that's the ways that other groups are involved, but not explicitly in our info shop. We're starting our own reading group that our next book is Our Enemies in Blue by Christian Williams. We will be meeting July 14th, which is a Wednesday at 7 p.m. And tentatively, we will be meeting here at North Star. That might change depending on how many people we have show up.
Our address is 833 Southeast Main Avenue, just two blocks north of Hawthorne on 9th. And our hours are 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. every day.
That was Shanti and Jordy from North Star Info Shop. We'll now listen to an excerpt reading by Christian Williams about Our Enemies in Blue, the book that is this month's reading group selection for North Star Info Shop.
I'm going to talk today about Our Enemies in Blue. Mostly the book is a history of the police in the United States. It actually begins in the colonial period before there was this modern institution of police. And it examines how these guys with the blue uniforms and the squad cars that we're all familiar with evolved out of earlier pre-modern law enforcement institutions. And in particular, it traces their evolution from an institution called the Slave Patrols, which was specifically responsible for regulating the lives of slaves in the South. And then it follows the story for, you know, approximately the next 200 years, looking at how the police have changed during that time and the social forces that have shaped that. I'm not actually going to talk very much in the next little bit about that history. Instead, I'm going to talk about policing and violence. And I thought that that would probably be a good thing to focus on given recent events here in Oakland, in particular the murder of Oscar Grant and also the shootout with Lavelle Nixon and the four cops who died as a result of that. So I'm going to read a little bit from the first chapter of my book, which is called Police Brutality in Theory and Practice. We're encouraged to think of acts of police violence more or less in isolation, to consider them as unique, unrelated occurrences. We ask ourselves always what went wrong, and for answers, we look to the seconds, minutes, or hours before the incident. Perhaps this leads us to fault the individual officer. Perhaps it leads us to excuse him. Such thinking, derived as it is from legal reasoning, does not take us far beyond the case in question, and thus such inquiries are rarely very illuminating. Of the famous instances of police violence, the shooting of Timothy Thomas, the beating of Rodney King, the arrest of Marquette Frye, the killing of Arthur McDuffie, and now we can add the murder of Oscar Grant, any of these may be explained in terms of the actions and attitudes of the particular officers at the scene, the events preceding the violence, including the actions of the victims, and the circumstances in which the officers found themselves. Indeed, some police administrators have frequently found it possible to excuse police violence with just such explanations. The unrest that followed these incidents, however, cannot be explained in such narrow terms. To understand the rioting, one must consider the whole range of related issues, including the conditions of life in the black community, the role of the police in relation to that community, and the history and pattern of similar abuses. If we are to understand the phenomenon of police brutality, we must get beyond particular cases. We can better understand the actions of individual police officers if we understand the institution of which they are a part. That institution, in turn, can best be examined if we have an understanding of its origins, its social function, and its relation to larger systems like capitalism and white supremacy. Let's begin with the basics. Violence is an inherent part of policing. The police represent the most direct means by which the state imposes its will on the citizenry. When persuasion, indoctrination, moral pressure, and incentive measures all fail, there are the police. In the field of social control, the police are specialists in violence. They are armed, trained, and authorized to use force. With varying degrees of subtlety, this colors their every action. Like the possibility of arrest, the threat of violence is implicit in every police encounter. Violence, as well as the law, is what they represent. According to a 2005 Justice Department survey, 19% of the American public had direct contact with the police during the previous year. I'm using the most recent stats available, so there's nothing magical about 2005. That's just the last year for which the figures are in. Most of these contacts took the form of traffic stops, and most were unremarkable. Only 1.6% involved the use or threat of force. Now, that may not sound like a lot until you realize that 1.6% is a polite way of saying nearly 500,000 people, an estimated 435,000. 400,000 people, if we got them all together, would make for a fair-sized city, larger than Atlanta, Georgia, and almost as large as Fresno, California. And when you orient yourself to the fact that this city could be reproduced every year, you start to get some picture of how common police violence really is.
That was Christian Williams, author of Our Enemies in Blue, the current selection for the North Star InfoShop Reading Group. Next up is Miley Speakman of the Portland Feminist Reading Group. They also meet at North Star InfoShop.
Hi, my name is Miley Speakman. I'm a member of the Portland Feminist Reading Collective that has recently started here in Portland. I recently graduated from Lewis and Clark College. At school, we had a feminist theory class in the fall, and a bunch of folks from that class had a really great time, and we really enjoyed that space. And so that was kind of one part of why the group started, because many members of that group had expressed a desire to kind of continue it. But also, I'm kind of part of some more radical or activist communities that had also expressed a desire to have kind of a space to read feminist texts and talk about them. So this group has been a kind of a manifestation of hearing all these people that I know express a desire to meet and read things together, and me really just deciding to maybe catalyze or try to put something together this summer to get people all meeting in the same space and reading the same text.
Can you talk about the importance of having particularly feminist space?
I've identified as a feminist for a really long time, and a lot of people around me identify as feminists, but in some ways, to me, it was really strange that the only feminist space I had ever inhabited was through the liberal arts school that I went to. And that felt really wrong to me. I think there's so much in that spirit of reading something together, talking about it out loud, sharing ideas. That's in a feminist way of being, a feminist way of reading books. And I really wanted to see a space outside of a very privileged space such as liberal arts college where we could all do that together. For me, feminism is the ideology that structures the way I see the world, and I see it as a really empowering and liberating set of ideas. And so I really didn't want to leave school and then feel like that set of ideas wouldn't be something that was continue to be part of my life. And so that's why I see it as so important to just continue thinking about those things. Part of the spirit of the group, I think, too, is to challenge what people's notions of feminism are. Because, for example, the first book we read talks about the prison industrial complex. It has a political and an economic analysis to it. It talks about marginalized women of color, working class women. And it really is not your, you know, standard second wave white feminist text. It's a really different type of text. And I think for me, if I'm going to use feminism as the structuring ideology of the way I live, it has to include all sorts of political and economic systems and a broader analysis that's not just about gender, but includes gender in a really central way.
What are other books that are on your list in the future?
So we have This Bridge Called My Back by Sherry Moraga and Gloria Anzaldúa. Angela Davis, an autobiography. Color of Violence by the Insight Collective. Feminist Theory from Margin to Center by Bell Hooks. The Revolution Will Not Be Funded, again by the Insight Collective. The Ethical Slut, talking about polyamory. Those are some titles that are on the possibilities list right now. We meet at North Star Info Shop every other Tuesday. Our next meeting is on Tuesday the 13th of July. We will be reading, I believe, the first 128-ish pages of Nobody Passes by Matilda Bernstein Sycamore.
That was Miley Speakman of the Portland Feminist Reading Collective. They can be contacted through Facebook or through the North Star Info Shop. Next up, we have an interview with Matilda, the editor of Nobody Passes, broadcast on KPFA Radio's Women's Magazine on December 11th, 2006. The first voice you will hear is of Women's Magazine host Lisa Detmer.
Matilda is the author of a novel, Pulling Taffy, and the editor of three nonfiction anthologies, That's Revolting, Queer Strategies for Resisting Assimilation, Dangerous Families, Queer Writing on Surviving, and Tricks and Treats, Sex Workers Write About Their Clients. Matilda's new novel, So Many Ways to Sleep Badly, Will Destroy Literature. And Matilda is an instigator of gay shame, a virus in the system, a radical queer activist group that fights the monster of assimilation. So this is a really interesting book, and I think an important book. What's it about?
The question I want to ask with the book is, if we weren't always required to pass as, you know, the right gender, the right race, the right class, the right sexuality, age, ability, body type, sexual practice, political party, member of the correct exercise trend of the moment, the right spiritual gimmick, you know, all of these different things. If we weren't required to pass all the time, what devious and devastating opportunities for transformation might we create? The problem with a narrow identity politics is things, instead of becoming starting points, they become an end point. So, for example, you know, a lot of my work has been about gay assimilation. And so we can see the ways in which a gay elite has hijacked queer struggle in order to position their desires as everyone's needs. So we see the signs of straight conformity, things like marriage, military service, adoption, have become the ultimate signs of gay success. That's the ultimate nightmare of identity politics, where things like housing and healthcare and the benefits of citizenship and homelessness and police brutality, those are suddenly not considered, you know, those are not gay issues, right? A gay issue by this, you know, nightmare of identity politics is something like marriage. Well, how did marriage become a gay issue? And this book, in a lot of ways, came about through my work challenging the violence of gay assimilation. And so in doing that, I wanted to examine all the different kinds of cultural erasure that assimilation, you know, mandates. So I wanted to look at passing as a means through which the violence of assimilation takes place.
How do you feel like this is upsetting that gender binary all the way around?
You know, it's using gender as a starting point from which to tear everything else apart. I want to take on all of the different sort of passing spectacles that are going on right now. So things like immigration, racial profiling, different kinds of identities in trans communities, all of these things, you know, side by side. I'm starting as an assumption with, you know, sort of tearing binary gender norms to shreds. I want to sort of dissect and challenge like all these categories, and both to confront societal mores of passing, so like passing into the dominant culture. So things like Condoleezza or something, here's a classic example of passing. We have Robert Gates, Iran-Contra war criminal, who's being confirmed as Secretary of Defense. And, you know, we have Carl Levin, this firebrand, you know, of the left, because he supports withdrawal from Iraq. Oh, my God, how did he even think of that idea, you know? And what does he say, you know, after the hearings? He says, oh, I think Robert Gates has an open mind, you know, and so it's those kinds of crimes that happen based on people wanting to assimilate into whatever norms they are. And so we have norms like U.S. state terror, and then we also have norms that are counterculture norms. So we have norms like, what does it take to pass as someone who's sufficiently genderqueer? So someone who is outside of the traditional binaries of gender. Or, for example, in the book, there are a lot of pieces that examine misogyny in trans communities and the ways in which someone will take on an identity that initially, I mean, the idea of a transgender identity is that these binary categories are false. But someone who will assimilate as a transgender person and take on all the worst aspects of, for example, a racist, misogynist masculinity. So there are a lot of pieces in the book that are sort of engaged on that continuum. And then there are a lot of pieces where, you know, it starts with one thing, and then just when you think you know what it's about, it turns around and it's about something entirely different. So it's these kind of like intersectional politics that I'm like most interested in exploring. I think straight people on the left often forget, say, basic feminist politics, for example. Like, oh, well, marriage, you know, oh, right, marriage. That's, oh, there's a central institution of patriarchy. I forgot about that. It's a central place where anti-women, anti-child, anti-queer violence takes place. I guess I should be challenging marriage, not, you know, reifying it as this amazing, incredible civil rights struggle. Beyond that, I'm interested in engaging a much different question, which is how do we enable people to choose their identities in as many ways as possible? You know, when someone passes, someone else fails. I want to make those passings visible. In making them visible, we can figure out, like, oh, well, does this work and does this not work?
That was Matilda on KPFA Radio's Women's Magazine, recorded December 11th, 2006. You are listening to Circle A Radio here on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Tonight, we present a summer reading show with ideas from people who run bookstores and book groups, printers, publishers, and readers.
Circle A Radio caught up with author and activist Yousef Shakur at the Allied Media Conference in Detroit, Michigan. Shakur's recent book is entitled The Window to My Soul, My Transformation from a Zone 8 Thug to a Father and a Freedom Fighter. Grace Lee Boggs, a Detroit-based radical organizer and philosopher, has participated in movements for civil rights, black power, labor, environmental justice, and feminist movements for the past 7 decades. She wrote in the progressive newspaper, The Michigan Citizen. If your summer reading includes only one book, I recommend Yousef Shakur's The Window to My Soul.
My name is Yousef Shakur. I'm an author of the book, The Window to My Soul, My Transformation from a Zone 8 Thug to a Father and Freedom Fighter.
Can you tell our listening audience where we are right now?
We're in Detroit, Michigan. My bookstore, The Urban Network, and also my neighborhood, Zone 8.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about your neighborhood, and that gets into what your book is actually about?
My neighborhood is a reflection of the many neighborhoods in Detroit that has been lost its way on multiple levels through neglect, social neglect, educational neglect, cultural neglect, and through that neglect, I and other individuals began to engage in criminal behavior. I began to engage in criminal behavior through a gang called Zone 8. That's the name from my neighborhood. We got that name from the police. But a lot of people don't realize I didn't mention doing a tour. It's based upon our zip code, 4028. That's where we get Zone 8. And it became kind of like a country. You know, it was our identity. It was our nationality. We defended our nationality. We defended our country against other individuals from other countries and things. For 7-8 years, I was part of that army. I was part of that warfare that helped tear my community. I would end up snatched out of that situation, where I ended up going to prison for a crime I didn't do. But again, I recognized that I helped create that atmosphere. And I ended up going to prison at the age of 19. And while in prison, I would meet my father. I meet my father for the first time. I knew of him as the man that the sperm donated, but as the father, I met him in prison. And it was a blessing for me that he had changed his life. He had redeemed his life, which had a tremendous impact on me to change my life. Ended up serving 9 years in prison. I've been home 9 years. And I say that because it's unheard of. God, do 9 years, come home 9 years, and consistently come out. And it's not been easy at all. It's still not easy. The obstacles that I've faced, you know, since I've been home, I graduated from college. I've written and published my own book, The Window to My Soul. Been out 2.5 years. I've sold over 2,500 copies. It's a powerful story. It's a compelling story. It's been compared and been considered the Malcolm X of the day. you know, where, you know, similar, it's similar in regards to the truth. The compellingness of it that jumps off and it grabs you and invites you in because it walks you through who the mindset of who I was as JoJo. And by the time you hit the end of the chapter, you understand that transformation to Yusef Bunchy Shakur.
Can you talk about how you came to open the bookstore?
I opened a bookstore based upon, you know, me right here locally, we're sitting in Detroit, going to different bookstores and trying to get them to, you know, sell my book. And for whatever reason, they didn't. So I felt selling your bookstore, I opened up my own bookstore. And also, in the vision of that is to try to eliminate other local authors, because a lot of people don't have the tough skin that you and I may have. And something like that can be that turning point from being a criminal to being an everyday citizen. So trying to, you know, be a breeding ground for positivity and for that individual saying that what you're doing is right and supporting that. But also it's a place of the culture, a culture of love in a place that you see in my neighborhood that's not breeding that on a day-to-day basis. It's a multi-purpose store. You know, we do multiple things. Now, not only we sell books, we sell African art, we do fish fry, we do a movie night. We do multiple things to engage the community. We rent the space out to hold community dialogues and things like that. So, like, you know, I'm honored to be a part of the Alameda Conference as a place to let people from around the country to come in and see what's going on. You know, unfortunately, like in Detroit, I think we're maybe, it's only like 3 bookstores in Detroit, and a lot of them are dying off. And, like, so I was just talking to somebody, and they were telling me, like, man, and they would tell me how proud I am to have the courage to open up a bookstore. You know, most people open up liquor stores, open up car washes. They're not opening up bookstores and things, you know. Again, I know it's a challenge to read, but it's there. It's available. It's a new option. It's a new vision. It's a new image for these guys to see.
Since our audience is on the West Coast, and then we also broadcast in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and Moscow, Idaho, can you tell people who might be listening to this in other parts of the country, where can they get a hold of your book or your business partner's books or any of the books that you guys publish?
All right, they can go to the website, which is www.yusefshakur.org, or they can call me directly at 313-459-6008. Glad you mentioned it, that we got another book that we published through the company. It's called Stop Snitching. It posed the question, does it really reduce crime in the black community? And then what it does is it pulls the covers off of it. That snitching is not what's perpetuating crime in the black community or any community. It's the lack of economics in the community that's perpetuating crime. And what we're saying is once we can bring the neighbor back to the community, that immediately reduces crime. You know, if you and I are neighborly, once you leave your house, I'm all automatically going to watch your house because it's a vested interest there, and vice versa. But if I don't care about you, of course I'll let somebody come and ramshack you. And so that right there alleviates the police. Because why? I'm policing my community. You're policing your community. And then also on a larger level, if we brought them into some problems that you and I can't deal with, then we invite the police in. Then we call on the police. But in other words, now it's certain protocol. And even if you, and I'm willing to bet you talk to any police, they will tell you that. That's the protocol. Because the police can't be everywhere. It's not enough police. And by saying that, no, stop snitching or things of that nature, people are not realizing what you are. You asking for a police state? Because I don't think we really don't want a police state. If we have a police state that really denies us of our so-called democracy, right, in a so-called democracy country.
Anything else you want to say to folks?
Oh man, I'm just one man of many. Wanting to make a contribution, and also too, my book is a powerful and dynamic story. And, you know, more importantly, I didn't write my book as a form of rags to riches, but a rags to liberation. My book is to save as many lives as I possibly can. And I encourage everybody to go on the website and get it. I encourage anybody to call me directly if you got any questions. Again, the number is 313-459-6008. We have another book that's coming out again in a couple of weeks called Scribes of Redemption, Letters from Incarcerated Father to Incarcerated Son, which is the book. It's kind of like the sequel. It's the letters that me and my father, or the my father wrote to me. And so it further takes you into that transformation. Not only my transformation, my father. Then we have another book that's coming out, which is the curriculum guide to my book, which will be available for high schools, middle schools, and youth programs to be able to utilize, to engage these young folks. Because I talk to young folks all the time. And after I get done, they be like, man, I would love to read your book. How can I read your book? Where can I get it? So the same young folks that we're saying that they don't want to read or they can't read, they're begging the different. They just don't have something that will hold their interest. And my book is more than, it's not just glorifying at no level the gangsterism or the thugism that I did. What is glorifying the ignorance that governed my life. And that same ignorance that's governing our community today and showing how we can address that ignorance. And in my book offers solutions. It's not talking about the problems.
That was Yousef Shakur, community activist, author, business owner, and publisher in Zone 8, Detroit, Michigan. The second ever United States Social Forum kicked off in Detroit on June 22nd, with over 25,000 participants representing social movements from around the U.S. and the world. Down at Cobo Hall, the epicenter of social forum activity, Circle A Radio stopped by to see our friends at the AK Press table.
My name is Jen Yogi. I'm a volunteer at AK Press. My favorite book ever is Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace, which is not summer reading at all. I guess it could be, actually. It's a huge book. It's over 1,000 pages long. It's sort of in the postmodern camp. But there are a million themes in it that I think are really relevant to folks in radical movements. Specifically, there are themes of addiction and... gosh, I mean, sports, like, there's just a million different things in that book, but it's one of my favorites. And we sell it, not here at the AK Press table, but at Red Emma's in Baltimore. Red Emma's bookstore and coffeehouse is located in Baltimore, Maryland. It's been around for just over 5 years. And we don't identify specifically as anarchists because the collective members range from all kinds of different radical ideologies. But we are committed to collectively owned and operated consensus-based space. And so we have books, we have food, we have coffee, and we host free community events that anyone can attend.
Tell me about the popular books at the U.S. Social Forum.
Sure. Well, there are three that we've been selling a lot of this week. The first is by Cindy Milstein, who's actually here this week at the Social Forum. She wrote a short primer on anarchism and its applications, and the book specifically introduces folks who maybe don't know anything about anarchism just in really clear, accessible language. It's a short book. It's called Anarchism and Its Aspirations, and it's the first in a series called Anarchist Interventions that AK Press is putting out. The second one was the subject of its own workshop. It's called Nowtopia, How Pirate Programmers, Outlaw Bicyclists, and Vacant Lot Gardeners Are Inventing the Future Today. It was written by Chris Carlson, and it's a really fun book about what folks are doing outside of the traditional capitalist workforce. So anyone who's interested in, you know, social networking or in cooperative movements should really check this one out. And then the last one, the book of the U.S. Social Forum, is called Uses of a Whirlwind, Movement, Movements, and Contemporary Radical Currents in the United States. There's been a panel about it at the Anarchist Convergence Space, which AK Press, along with Red Emma's Bookstore and Coffee House in Baltimore, Maryland, they've kind of organized this radical anarchist convergence space. And this has been the subject of a lot of really excellent discussions and workshops at the Social Forum. It's been selling like hotcakes.
So, and then I wanted to ask you, just personally, what book or books have been inspiring to you?
Well, I have to say, whenever someone asks me that question, my first thought is always to bell hooks. I really got into my identity as a radical feminist woman of color through a lot of her books. So anyone who's interested, feminism is for everybody. Of course, feminist movement from margin to center. And she's got a relatively recent one about belonging and the philosophy of place and culture that I'd really recommend.
I'm Charles, and I'm with Eberhardt Press, which is a local Portland print shop and publishing house. It's been around for about 5 years and still going pretty strong. Do printing for the community and for activist groups and et cetera, you know, publish a few things, not a whole lot. The press is named after Isabel Eberhardt, who was an anarchist writer. I sort of quit my own publishing efforts for quite a while because I just couldn't afford to the printing bills, you know, and immediately began thinking, you know, well, maybe if I had my own press, you know, then I could just do my own thing and everything. And that was sort of just hazy kind of dream off in the distance. And then about 7 or 8 years ago, a friend put me in touch with one of their friends who had a press that was up for grabs. Has been here ever since, churning out page after page of various texts from a radical perspective. There are a lot of good quotes regarding, you know, the state's regard for independent publishing. There's one quote, essentially, that says the state fears printing presses more than it fears bombs and guns. That's the power, especially in a climate of repression, that independent voices have when challenging authority. So there's a lot of different reasons, you know, depending on the level of conflict with the state.
Offset printing, because it's not burdened with the need to be the sort of donkey that the weight of the printed world rides on, you know, it can also become an art form. And if you're willing to make a little investment and put in some time, you can set up your own print shop and print whatever the hell you want.
You know, there have been a lot of people expressing their opinions on all the police violence that's taken place in Portland, for instance, over the past year or so, and further back, of course, but especially the last few months. A lot of people are publishing their own leaflets and flyers and putting a real diversity of opinions out there and different perspectives on these shootings that have happened. And so I think that's a real local, specific example, I guess, of how important it is for people to be able to express themselves in print and how that is still a relevant vehicle for communication, even in the age of the blogosphere.
The quality of offset is far better than photocopying. No matter how good the photocopiers get, you're still taking carbon-based toxic toner and fusing it onto the surface of a sheet of paper. So if you rub it, wear and tear, if you carry it around in your backpack for a long time, the toner will start to rub off and it'll just go to pieces. Printing, you know, the ink actually bonds with the fibers of the sheet of paper. It's a much deeper process. It makes a much more permanent impression. So if you want somebody to be able to actually read something that you're printing in 100 years, you know, offset's a good way to go, because I don't know how photocopiers are going to hold up over time, honestly. I've gone to printers before and had jobs rejected because of political content. It wasn't like really explicit. They just asked me not to come back anymore. And there's other print shops that'll print whatever you bring them. They're not going to give you a hard time because of the content, but just the possibility that can happen, you know, is problematic. And depending on what it is that you're communicating, you know, you really might want to have it under your own hands and not have it going through someone else's setup. People's zines, I mean, we're creating our own culture in a way. I don't want to say subculture so much, because, I mean, everything's a subculture depending on where your position is, but we're creating our own literature, our own culture, our own artwork, our own communications to each other. Our people are expressing themselves creatively in all sorts of ways. To me, some of the most interesting work I've done, it's definitely like people's zines, you know, and some of the most creative and interesting stuff. You get opportunities to do all sorts of stuff that you just don't get to do with commercial corporate printing. Primarily are here to serve anarchist and anti-authoritarian publishers, people who ultimately reject the system of capitalism and the effects that that's having on the planet, on human relations, on everything, you know. But the more that the means of producing your own printed material, the more it's in different people's hands outside of this contained system, face it, the safer we are in our ability to communicate. Right now, if they pull the plug on the internet, what would people do, you know?
We published a few different books. The first original publication was a book documenting Iraqi resistance to the Iraq War back around 2004. We've reprinted a few different classic anarchist texts, like At Daggers Drawn, which is sort of an insurrectionary essay about resistance in the context of globalization and sort of current epoch.
The following is an excerpt from the book Fire to the Powder Keg, War and Social Guerrilla Struggle in Iraq, available through Eberhardt Press. Contrary to what happened in Vietnam, the American Army operating today in Iraq is a professional army composed of soldiers who have chosen to fight. This is a completely relative choice, since for most of those who have enlisted, it is a direct consequence of their social condition. Those who recruit cannon fodder have always known that an impoverished individual without prospects will be more inclined to accept the benefits the fatherland offers to those who serve its military. A wage, a piece of land, a university scholarship, a residence permit, or a handful of dollars. The possibilities for co-opting the poor into the defense of the nation are nearly endless. In fact, the Pentagon explicitly aims its recruitment propaganda at the most exploited and dispossessed, and uses the full force of advertising techniques to draw in the desperate. Promises of job training and benefits combined with images of power in which the protagonists are proud and determined young people of all colors, presenting the impression that the military can offer the dignity missing from the lives of the poor. Also, the Pentagon targets specific ethnic and racial groups among the exploited with more pointed publicity. An example that exposes the kinds of methods used can be found in the recruiting campaigns aimed at poor Latin American immigrants in the U.S. Many Latin American immigrants are of combat age and live in poor, often desperate conditions. Their position in U.S. society is usually quite precarious, especially if they lack papers. This leaves them particularly vulnerable to the extortion and promises of military recruiters. So the Pentagon has specifically promised green cards to all undocumented immigrants who enlist, as well as expedited citizenship. Poverty, combined with the desire to lessen the precariousness of their existence, has thus led 37,000 Latinos to join the military. But this is just one example of the way the Pentagon plays on the needs of specific groups among the exploited to get volunteers to act as cannon fodder for their various operations, and particularly for the current war. Similar tactics are used among all the poor, anyone vulnerable to the extortions imposed by a precarious existence. Desperation provides the military with the sort of cannon fodder they prefer, those who might cause trouble and even choose to fight for themselves if they remained at home. The recruitment programs are still not providing enough cannon fodder for the current war. The military needs an endless supply of human resources to feed its projects of domination. So U.S. recruitment sergeants have even been crossing the Mexican border in search of young people who have dropped out of school and are trying to obtain documents and residence in the United States. The generals consider the desire of many Mexican proletarians to obtain American citizenship to be decidedly positive, and thus don't hesitate to recruit them in exchange for the promise of a brand new ID card. The military experts call this strategy of aimed enlistment poverty recruitment. This strategy is in effect wherever there is a concentration of particularly poor proletarians within the United States and beyond its borders. In the United States, the dogs of war start their recruitment work in the elementary schools and extol the advantages of military life throughout the course of study, obviously including the university. This has led to the birth of several associations of resistance to this practice. The American Movement Against Recruitment is in its fifth strike against enlistment and the war. And the organization Students Not Soldiers has launched a campaign against the Army's presence in schools.
Thank you, Liam Delta, for reading that excerpt. Now we go back to our interview with Charles from Eberhart Press.
A lot of stuff we do is just stuff that's just useful, notepads, greeting cards, that it's sort of appealing to people's. I worked with a collective of women to publish the Collective Tarot, which has been really popular and off the beaten track a little bit from Eberhart Press's usual publications, but people have been really interested in it. And basically, like, it's a queer tarot deck. It's something that, where else are you going to find something like that? When you're doing a small publishing house, you can kind of take risks and try to do things and that wouldn't be done in a corporate setting, let's say, you know. The website address for Eberhart Press is www.eberhartpress.org.
That was Charles from Eberhart Press here on Circle A Radio. We now talk to one of the volunteers at Black Rose Info Shop. This is Tom.
I'm a volunteer at the Black Rose Info Shop. We're located on 4038 North Mississippi. We're a radical book store / community space that's working on promoting community in the neighborhood and in the greater Portland area. We have the bookstore part. That's how we pay our rent. We have a pretty fine selection of books and zines, also t-shirts and tapes and records. We also have the Free Cycle, which is a community free box. Basically, it's a large portion of the store. You can come in, bring stuff, lease stuff. We also have a lending library. It's pretty extensive. You can check out books. And it's also a space you can come out and hang around. Also, most of our prices are sliding scale. We are always taking donations, and you can bring those to the collective. We try to be open every day from 12 to 4 or from 4 to 8. Our email address is blackrosecollective@riseup.net if you're interested in contacting us further. Also, we're in need of volunteers. You can come in, and we're pretty friendly, so just come in during the day and have a chat with us.
We also spoke to Tom about what he was reading currently and what's on his reading list for the summer. He begins with a book he just finished.
Durruti and the Spanish Revolution. It's by Abel Paz, and it's about the anarchist general Buenaventura Durruti and his involvement in the Spanish Revolution. And the book basically follows his life and the life of the Spanish Revolution in Spain during 1936. This is a quote from Durruti. "I've been an anarchist all my life. I hope to continue being one. It would be very unpleasant to suddenly convert myself into a general and command my comrades with senseless military discipline. The comrades who have come here have done so willingly and are ready to give their lives for the cause that they defend. I believe, as I've always believed, in liberty, liberty understood in the sense of responsibility. I consider discipline indispensable, but it should be self-discipline motivated by a common ideal and a strong feeling of camaraderie." That's Durruti's response to being an anarchist general and the contradiction that one might see in it. The fascists definitely won the Spanish Revolution, and that brought on the rise of fascism in Nazi Germany and World War II. Or the Spanish Revolution didn't end that well for anarchists and communists and socialists and other left parties. The book documents a lot about the Spanish Revolution, but focuses mostly on Durruti. It definitely has goes into great historical detail about events that don't necessarily concern Durruti, but would be very interesting to learn about. I find the book particularly interesting because a large portion of the people in Spain were anarchists or identified as anarchists. That's really inspiring. And this was in 1936.
So are there any downsides to this summer reading choice?
It's a long book. It's about 800 pages. So it's, if you want to like stay in your room during the summer or sit on the in a park all summer, it would be a good choice. It's pretty disappointing to learn about the communist betrayal too of anarchists. Whole columns of anarchists were killed by communists.
Do you have any books on your list to start or continue or finish this summer?
Yes. I just read that. The Best of Intentions, the Avow anthology. It's written by Keith Rawson, who is a Portland native, and it's an anthology of the Avow zine. A lot of short stories, writings based on Keith's life and his involvement in punk, and short stories about his life. There's poetry in it and artwork. It's a nice summer read, a nice bathroom read. Also, I want to read The Coming Insurrection. It's about the Greeks. I browsed through it a few times, and there's some amazing pictures and some amazing inspirational stories in there about what's happening in Greece. It's mostly at the end of 2008, but what's happening in Greece now definitely reflects that.
We also asked our other interviewees about what they had been reading lately, as well as some other people we met at the U.S. Social Forum in Detroit.
What are you reading these days?
Oh, not enough, really. The Oregonians, frighteningly enough. You know, it's crazy the things that happen in Portland. Wow.
My name is Sekou Ujamaa, and one of the books I will recommend will be The Stolen Legacy and The Pale Horse, and it's pertaining to the miseducation of The Blacks in America. And it tells you the truth. When you don't know your history, someone else tell your history, and no one can tell your history better than you.
I've recently gotten interested in Makeshift Magazine. It's like an anti-capitalist feminist magazine that really focuses on the arts. It's really interesting, and they did kind of this, they called it the Makeshift Reclamation Tour, and a lot of artists and poets and all sorts of filmmakers, feminist filmmakers, did this tour where they showed all their art and texts and everything. And now that magazine is starting to publish a lot of this stuff. And so that's something I've recently been pretty interested in. I found a lot of resources through that I'm excited to explore.
I'm reading American Methods by Christian Williams. I'm halfway through, and it's really dense and hard to read because it's really heavy material. It's really good.
Hope Full of Flowers is a book that talks about evolution and change. You can read it in one setting. I wish I knew the author, but it's Hope Full of Flowers. It starts with two caterpillars. You got to read that. And often what I do is I get it and I usually read it to people because it's such a beautiful story. And the story really, you got to get it in again. Hope for the Flowers.
My name is Rukia Shabazz, out of Detroit, Viva Ghana. A recommendation I would like, The Destruction of an African Civilization, is by Dr. Chancellor Williams. The other one is that they came before Columbus. It just talks about Columbus came and discovered this country, but there were plenty of people here before he ever got here. That's a book I would recommend. And, you know, it's just so many other books. You know, the autobiography of Malcolm X is a wonderful book to read. Kwame Nkrumah, the biology of Kwame Nkrumah out of Ghana, who was the first president and the first country that got their independence. Okay.
I'm also reading this book called Extra Lives about video games.
So Eberhardt Press just helped publish a book called Winds from Below, Radical Community Organizing to Make a Revolution Possible, which was published by the Team Colors Collective. And it's actually the introduction to a book that's also been published basically last week by AK Press, which is called Uses of a Whirlwind. It's also an extended consideration of radical community organizing in the context of the times that we're in right now. Both of those I would recommend, particularly the Uses of a Whirlwind book from AK Press, and then Winds from Below you can probably find at various places around town, and also through AK Press, I'm sure.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Circle A Radio. All of the books, projects, authors, and websites that were mentioned will be on our webpage at kboo.fm/CircleA Radio. We also have old shows archived there, and you can send messages through the KBOO website or at CircleARadio@gmail.com. Circle A Radio airs the first and third Wednesday at 6 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. Our next show is July 21st. Thanks for listening.